quick intro for this one before we get started. We're going to talk about the Olympic quarterfinals, wrap that up by about 33 minutes or so, and if you're not interested in the Olympics, you can skip right to where the best and worst contracts since the lockouts part one begins. We get through 2013 with that, so it should be a good pod. Thanks for listening.
Lots to talk about on tonight's Downtown Basketball Podcast. The quarterfinal round of the Olympic basketball tournament is in the books. We saw some blowouts and a great game between Croatia and Serbia. We'll talk about all four of those games a little bit. Also preview the semifinals and hopefully the finals as well. We're also going to get into a segment we've been teasing for a bit now. The first half of our discussion of the best and worst contracts since the lockouts, kind of a companion piece to the podcast we did about this time last year on the worst trade since the lockout. It's a good one to listen to if you are someone who wasn't a listener at the time. That one holds up pretty well, I would imagine. But Danny, what did you think of this day of chock full of Olympic basketball action?
It was definitely chock full. I would say in total, it was about what I expected in terms of which games were competitive and which games weren't. The only one that was a little bit surprising was just how much Australia whooped Lithuania, but that was the outcome I expected, just a little bit different. And you talked about how I would classify the Croatia-Serbia game as exciting, not necessarily good, but it was certainly enjoyable.
As you mentioned today, of course, that we are sponsored by Blue Apron. Find out more about them at blueapron.com/capspace. And also Framebridge. I did my order, actually got my photo from them. I want to tell you guys about that a little bit later on. Framebridge.com promo code capspace is how you can utilize that website. Let's start. We'll just go in chronological order here with that Australia-Lithuania game. Australia absolutely throttled Lithuania on both ends of the floor. It was a nightmare game and really a nightmare tournament for Jonas Valanciunas.
Yeah, he struggled to hold on to the ball in this game. I thought that was actually more pronounced in their last group stage game, but it was still an issue. And, I mean, Bogut simply outplayed him. And also, I think it was important how well the Australian guards have continued to play and that they've actually meshed together, because you could imagine, while I hate the term point guard as rigid of a thing, both Deli and Patty Mills do well with the ball in their hands, and they've had to make that work.
Yeah, Lithuania also was hurt by Jonas Mačiulis, who's the closest thing they have to a stopper on the perimeter, getting into foul trouble very early on. Two quick fouls for him, and then a third once the game was really pretty much already out of reach or getting there in the second quarter. Dellavedova was, again, fantastic. He shot 4 out of 7 on threes. He would probably actually be my pick right now for MVP of the tournament. Only 3 assists this time, but he'd been averaging close to double figures in the preliminary round. And Patty Mills just was on fire. 24 points on 17 shooting possessions, 5 of 11 on threes. And that Australian offense really continues to bedevil everybody with their back cuts. And then they get you scared of the back cuts, and then they can pop out for threes. It really has been beautiful to watch under Coach Lamanis.
Yeah, they've kind of set themselves up also, not to get ahead of ourselves, in terms of, I think they ended up with a very fortuitous matchup with Serbia, because I think Serbia has some weaknesses that can be exploited in that way. And I've been a little bit impressed with the Australian depth, just because I wasn't super familiar with a lot of their guys outside of the starters, who are familiar, of course, to NBA fans, because they all have that kind of experience. But they've gotten some nice contributions from Martin, from David Anderson, and that's been really impressive.
For Lithuania, it started so well for them, and then in a game that it looked like they had absolutely nothing to play for in against Spain, they ended up losing by 50, and we'll never know, I guess, how much of that was them just trying to kind of taking it easy. As it turned out, because Croatia got upset by Nigeria, Lithuania could have won the group had they won that game against Spain, but Spain really looks like a nightmare matchup for Lithuania. They got destroyed by them in the final of Eurobasket last year, too. And we noted that Valanciunas really struggled. I mean, I thought that he was really trying to get his own post-ups more than really playing in pick and roll. Like, every time he set a screen, he was just whiffing on it because he was racing down to the low block to try to get position, and he wasn't able to get good position, and then he was either getting pressured up, turning it over, getting stripped down low. It seemed like every time he got the ball down there, he wasn't able to convert. So really just a struggle for him. Really probably the only guy you could look at as having a good tournament overall for Lithuania, when you consider how bad it was for them over the last 3 games, was Kalnietis, their point guard. Aside from that, I think really a disappointing flameout after how well they started.
Does this performance affect the way that you think about Valanciunas' role in the NBA long term? Because it concerns me a little bit on the idea that he could at some point be a larger fish in the Toronto pond.
Nah, nothing I see from NBA players except really young guys is going to affect what I think of them in their roles. I mean, if Nicola Batum, who we're going to get to, would be another one. And I think guys can definitely look bad at times in these tournaments if they just don't happen to be in shape at that particular time, or they were free agents that year. In the case of Batum, maybe that had something to do with his struggles, or they're just not used to the role. Or I think sometimes even their coaches will have almost an anti-NBA bias if the guy is not just like a total superstar, you know, along the lines of a Ginobili or a Gasol. So no, it doesn't make me think worse of Valanciunas. The guys we haven't seen yet in the NBA, like Kuzminskis, I thought we saw, and we'll talk about more about him in a wrap-up show, but I thought like his defense looks like it could be really problematic if they're going to try and play him at either forward position for the Knicks this year. So the younger guys, or the guys that I haven't seen that much, yeah, but if you have an established NBA role, I'm not going to start panicking about a bad FIBA tournament. And he looked great, actually, last year at Eurobasket, too.
Do you think that Australia's strength so far in this tournament, in the group play as well, is really more about them just beating up on, let's say, inferior competition just because the international pool seems a little bit softer this year? Or is this a team that could have held up, maybe not to, let's say, Spain in 08, but just more of the teams that were of that ilk?
Yeah, that's a tough call, isn't it? I mean, this offense has looked amazing. And I think the way that they've shot the ball, you wonder why it is that they've had most of these same guys before. This isn't some brand new thing for them. I mean, they didn't have Bogut in 2014, for example, I don't think. But, you know, I don't think he makes that big of a difference. And they've had him before at other times. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe you could say Delly and Mills are in their prime. I mean, I think the way Delly has played has been the key for them. And we'll see whether they can keep it up. But this offense sure looks unstoppable with the way they've moved the ball. And I guess this matchup with Serbia, who they already beat pretty badly, and then likely either Spain or the U.S. will really find out about these guys. If they beat either, if they win the gold medal, then yeah, I will agree with you. But it's too early to say that at this point. But they've done as well as you possibly could with the teams in front of them. I mean, they're just blowing people out too. That's the important thing here. They're not winning close games largely.
One thing I will note though is that the game against Serbia, it was pretty close until late, and then I think they ended up winning by 15, but I think it was within five, I believe, with less than 5 minutes to go. So it wasn't one of those games, like so many others that they've had, where they really blew the doors off everyone.
So Australia moving on. I guess we can just take the other side of the bracket now, that Croatia-Serbia game. The one close game we had, I was hoping for more close games, which was unfortunate. Croatia served
nice
served out to a 36-32 lead at halftime. Bogdanović was on fire. They tried Kalinic on him. That he got into foul trouble pretty quickly, and it was not looking great for Serbia. And then they had a monster third quarter. They put up 34 points on 22 possessions in that quarter, and then were able to hold on desperately at the end with some pretty ugly fouling.
Croatia's offense for a vast majority of the game was really horrendous, but they had two nice stretches. They had one in, I believe it was the second quarter, and then they had one in the fourth quarter to kind of come back into the game. That made you wonder why it was so stagnant the rest of the time. And I don't know if that's coaching or whatever it is, but I feel like they're a team, and this has been true in other international competitions in the last 5 years, where it feels like they could do a lot better with what they have. However, I am heartened by the talent that exists within the Croatian eligibility that could end up helping them in future national competitions. And so, I think having a big man who can defend at least a little bit more would be a big help. And Plotinic does a good job with what he is, but they don't have that real guy yet. And I think that even Dragan Bender, though he's not that kind of defender, just what he can do offensively might help them as well.
For Croatia, and we'll talk a little bit more about Serbia in a second, I think you talked about how their offense was really stagnant down the stretch. And the guy who deserves a lot of the credit for that was Marković for Serbia. He switched on to Bogdanović, and Bojan was not able to get the ball at all. When he tried to post him up, which has been very, very effective for him in this tournament, Marković was able to just stone him. And so they got to the point where the only way they could get Bogdanović the ball was to just let him bring it up. And then it was just high pick and roll with him and Planinich, and they were able to get some okay looks there, but it was real slow. They weren't moving the ball. They weren't really moving the Serbian defense, which is not a great defense if you can get them moving side to side and out in space. So he was great. I think Jokic, again, had another pretty nice game as well. He and Radulica were a pretty solid center combination throughout this whole tournament. And Teodosic, while he was only 2 out of 11, he'll have some rough shooting games on occasion, did have 10 assists and hit some key free throws late, and also set up Bogdan Bogdanovic, who was 4 of 7 from 3 and had 18 points in 26 minutes.
Well, and there was something that Serbia did, particularly in the second half, I think it was even in the fourth quarter, that was notable, that where they were generating a lot of quality looks in the last 5 seconds of the shot clock, and some of that was their own just things materializing at that point, and some of it was also that Croatia just couldn't hold it together defensively for that long. It's something that we've talked about for various NBA teams in terms of just making them work for a longer period of the shot clock. That Teodosic pass to Bogdanovic was another example of that. I think he made that pass with about 4 seconds left on the shot clock. They hadn't really created much, and they had done a nice job holding it, and then he just throws this laser, boom, 3 points, just like it had been an easy one at the beginning of the clock.
Let's talk about the last 30 seconds of the game. It was Croatia within 2, I believe.
I think they got it to 1.
I think it was 2. Because, okay. And then Serbia took a shot. Radulica was under the glass, but the ball bounced out to the opposite side. And there was a foul, which, you know, he kind of got grabbed a little bit. But they call it a loose ball rebound foul when the ball was 15 feet away from him. I hate those calls so much. Like, don't call those unless it's actually affecting who gets the rebound or doesn't. And then Radulica was able to make 1 out of 2. That put the Serbs up 3, because then they were able to get into their fouling game, and they prevented Croatia. They started fouling with 20 seconds left, way earlier than most NBA teams would foul. But Croatia was never able to actually get a shot to tie the game because the Serbs did such a nice job of fouling them.
This is something that I have actually advocated for, mostly privately, just because I know fans would hate the experience, that I've actually advocated for NBA teams with really good free throw shooters to do. An example of this actually would be now that they have Durant with the Warriors, because they'll have 2 guys that are ludicrously good. Because not only do you have the benefit of preventing the team from potentially getting the game-tying shot, but if you have the right personnel, you actually have an advantage if you're playing the free throw game, where you're more likely to even just make more of them and take it from a 3-point lead to a 4-point lead.
Yeah, you know what? I apologize. You were right. They did go up 4 there, but then they did foul at that point, got within 2, and then Serbia hit 1 out of 2 with Markovic, and that's when they were up 3 and started the fouling. But it was, I mean, I'm so glad that NBA teams don't do it that way, because it was miserable. It took forever. We never got to see them actually hit the tying shot. At one point, though, it was a 4-point game with about maybe 7 seconds left, and Serbia fouled again, which I thought was a bad idea if your point is to never let them actually get a tying shot, because then Croatia could have just missed that free throw intentionally, gotten the rebound, and gotten a 3 attempt off. But Croatia then never tried that, and Croatia also never made the attempt of just pressing and going for the steal. They just fouled immediately every time. Knowing what the strategy was from Serbia, I would have liked to have seen more of that from them. But let's be happy that NBA teams don't use this strategy. And I think actually that coaches are almost kind of too scared to use this strategy, because you look really bad if it backfires, because then it's like, okay, the coach lost the game, and so the players lost us the game by giving up the shot. It may actually be a better strategy, but I hope we don't see it, because game-tying threes are awesome.
And it was just miserable basketball to watch. And while the rest of the game, you know, had its sloppy, strange moments, including the most bizarre barrage of scoop shots I think I've ever seen, but it was still interesting and entertaining in its own way. And then to see it just get marred by what was justifiable but still unwatchable decisions is just tough.
Yeah, another thing that was incredibly entertaining was Radulica just ending Dario Saric
Jesus
with a dunk. And if Radulica would like to get a framed photo of that dunk, the best place for him to go would clearly be Framebridge. Framebridge has now solved the problem that I had as a young adult, which is basically that framing stuff is ridiculously expensive if you go to a frame store. I remember there's this place where I grew up in Evanston, Illinois, and my mom used to take us to this frame store called Goods, and I couldn't believe how much she was paying to get just like normal pictures framed. It was hundreds of dollars, and she's like, well, sorry, like if you want to have a framed picture, like this is what it costs. And so I've always kind of been reticent to do that. And now with FrameBridge, it is much easier and much cheaper. Their prices start at $39. All shipping is free. If you go to FrameBridge.com and use the promo code CastSpace, you can save an additional 15% off your first order. And really, the customer service there is the best part. You get just as good a customer service as you would get going to an actual store. They have a service where you can actually ask one of their experts to give you a recommendation of four frames that would work with the photo that you simply just upload to their site, and they will print it for you in very high quality, put it in the frame, and send it back to you. The process took about a week and a half for me from the moment that I started up there. I uploaded the photo. Their representative got in touch with me, sent me the four frames. My girlfriend and I picked one, and they sent it back. It was all over within a week and a half. So incredibly easy and so much less expensive than going to a traditional frame store. FrameBridge.com, promo code CapSpace. Easy to remember. We talk about CapSpace all the time on the program, and that also lets them know that you came from us. FrameBridge.com, promo code CapSpace. I was heartened for the U.S. when they drew Argentina, because I had thought, I don't think we said this on the last show when we talked about what some of their issues were, but I felt like they basically had about a 60% chance of winning the tournament. That was before we knew who they were going to be playing, but I knew that Argentina just would not have a chance against them because they didn't have the athleticism, they didn't have the defense, they didn't really have any kind of big men at this point who can rebound. And so the way the U.S. destroyed them in the exhibition, I thought that was very indicative of how this game would go. And after an early hiccup where they were down 19-9, the U.S. went on a 27-2 run and basically never looked back. My question for you is, are you heartened by this performance in terms of what it could mean for the semifinals and the finals for the U.S.?
A little bit. They switching out Cousins for DeAndre Jordan certainly helped defensively. It wasn't perfect. I mean, they still have a lot of flaws in their defense. And so they actually got into some different lineups that worked. Part of that was actually helped by Carmelo Anthony getting in foul trouble. I'm not saying ticky-tack fouls to criticize the officials. They're ticky-tack fouls that he shouldn't have made. And so that actually allowed them, forced their hand, actually, Coach K's hand, to try some of these more defense and offense mixed lineups. And as soon as they started doing that, they looked a lot better. And I mean, if he could look at Paul George playing with those guys, you know, the lineup where it was Kyrie, I believe, but it was Paul George, Clay, Durant, and DeAndre, and they just wrecked that. Oh yeah, we can actually do this. I mean, that's pretty much the best lineup that I support, though I would have Lowry instead of Kyrie. And it really worked. And the reason why is because they have a combination of offense and defense, and they have players like Paul George that can take a smaller usage role if they want, so Durant can kind of free up, but you have plenty of defensive talent. So if they can take the right lessons from it, that's great. However, I feel like I'm making the same qualification that I did on the Chicago Bulls and Derrick Rose trade. And when I make that kind of a thing, when the track record is the opposite, I have to be a little bit concerned.
Yeah, they played the defensive guys more. Those guys looked good. Kyle Lowry was awesome in this game, even though his shot has been off. Just his energy and the defensive communication wasn't fantastic, but with him, Paul George also really took his defense to a different level. Jimmy Butler got more time defensively. The communication on the switching was much better. And just not having Kyrie, Carmelo, and Cousins all on the floor at the same time really helped. I think at least Coach K had some realization that the defense just wasn't good enough and they needed to make a change there, and that Cousins was getting beat up. And then Cousins was able to come in. This is just a perfect matchup for him because Luis Scola trying to guard him in the paint, or D'Elia off the bench, had no chance either. So Cousins actually performed very well and hit the offensive glass when he's able to just put guys in the goal. I don't think that really augurs him doing nearly as well against teams with real defensive big men, but he was good for this game. I was still a little disheartened that Draymond Green didn't play as much. He had a nice stretch down the end of the second quarter, but then did not play very well in garbage garbage time in the fourth. And then KD was able to get going too. I like that they played with greater intensity. I like that they switched more, that they were able to execute those switches. But other than that, I mean, the defense in the first 6-7 minutes of the game was just as terrible as it had always been. And they still had a lot of mistakes. This Argentina team was not really a real matchup, frankly. And I think I'm a little bit heartened because they played harder, but still extremely worried about this matchup with a Spain team that is just on fire lately.
And a Spain team that knows how to attack a defense and that has, they don't have perfect personnel like to face the U.S., but they can make them work. They're actually probably the closest team in terms of execution to Australia, and Australia gave the U.S. fits defensively.
We should spend a little bit of time discussing what now appears to be the sunset for the golden generation of Argentina. Luis Scola, I don't think he specifically said it was going to be his last game, but you have to imagine
it would
be.
He pretty much did.
Yeah,
he's not even sure if he's going to be walking in 4 years. So I think that's a pretty big sign.
Yeah, Manu as well. He was tearful after the game. The Argentina fans there gave them a great goodbye with their singing, which according to observers, there was actually prompted by Brazilian fans chanting at them that they were out of the tournament. And so then the Argentina fans responded to give these guys a proper send off. It's really a shame for Argentina that they were not able to really develop a follow-up to that golden generation. I mean, Campazzo really is the only guy on this team who's any good between like 35 and 23. And Delfino now is on the other side. He's had all those foot problems. I don't know why it is that Argentina hasn't been able to come up with more talent, what it was that enabled this generation to exist. But from 2002 and 2004, it was really, you know, one of the most beautiful basketball teams that we saw in any format.
Yeah, and I think in some ways the fact that they were able to not only reach the heights that they did, but extend it for as long as they did is so impressive, because you think about how a lot of organizations internationally, you know, the U.S. does it with, of course, substantially more talent, and, you know, not only in terms of population, but in terms of just the people in the country that play the sport. And to not only win a gold medal, but to be as consistently competitive as they have, and to do it largely with the same players. I mean, Fabricio Oberto was a part in the earlier segment of it, and he's not anymore. But really, like Nocioni, Manu, Scola, you know, like that group has been so massive for a team that did that. And it's I wouldn't say it's unprecedented in that way, but it's incredibly significant. And it resonated at least with me, just because for my entire adult life, they've been relevant on the international scene. And there isn't really anyone like them that really fits that bill.
Yeah, when I tweeted that I thought that Argentina was definitely the best matchup for the U.S. in this round, I got retweeted by someone influential in Argentina and immediately became very happy that I don't understand Spanish very well, given my mentions. But there was a lot of Atenas and 2004, along with many other more colorful terms. And frankly, if that 2004 team had matched up with the U.S., I think they probably would have been favored, frankly. And Nocioni, another guy, had just a great throwback game against Brazil to even get them to this point, because they would not have made it, I don't think, if they had lost to Brazil in that game to even make it.
Because Brazil would have been 3-2, and they would have been 2-2.
Yeah, yeah. So one more heroic performance for these guys, given their ages, I think, to even get this far was very impressive. To even qualify out of the Tournament Americas last year was impressive, and we're going to really miss these guys. Zach Lowe wrote a great piece about Manu and about the Argentina legacy that I highly recommend reading if you want to give a proper farewell to these guys. But now we move on to the U.S. and Spain. Spain crushed France in the rubber match of what had been a great series, with each team winning on the other's soil in the last 2 years. And it was Spain's three-point shooting that really carried them, especially in the first half. They ended up only 10 out of 28, but a lot of that was in garbage time. And France, again, really disappointing. This is not a great Spanish defense necessarily. They only put up 67 points, and a lot of that even was garbage time too. Shot 37.5% on twos for France and only got 14 three-point shots off didn't get to the foul line at all either. It was really just a very, very ugly performance for France. I mean, what do you take away from this with France now? Were you as disappointed in them as I was?
Yes, I was massively disappointed in them because France has an incredibly high conceptual ceiling. And
they have more talent than Spain. They have certainly have more NBA talent. If you made an NBA team out of each of these guys, each of these teams, you probably would have a better team for France. I mean, it's not the same rules, obviously, especially because Gasol can be much more effective under FIBA rules than in the NBA. But nonetheless, with both the shorter three-point line and the no defensive 3 seconds. But man, I mean, this French offense is just atrocious.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they really have a kind of a theory of their offense, which is a big concern. And just the playing Parker and DeColo when they do that more together instead of separating and making sure you get reliable minutes from them is something that's bothered me for a while. But all the points you brought up were very well made, and I agree with all those. The thing that bothered me the most about France in this game was their second unit defense, because they just didn't do anything to make Spain work for their shots. And so in those segments of the game, Spain was just either a layup line or open 3-point shots. And that just was you couldn't survive that if you're France. And I mean, so it was Joffre Laverne and Boris Diaw most of that time. And, those guys are talented players, but they don't provide that kind of an identity. And that gave Spain an out, even if their starters hadn't been as good as they were.
Yeah, Hernan Gomez was just rolling to the rim every time for
just
a stretch
on effort.
There.
Like, he wasn't outskilling them. He wasn't, using any moves. He was just running to the basket and like, oh, look at what I found, because they can actually pass me the ball.
Yeah, Spain ended up 64% on twos. They shot it great from three-point range early on. And for France, Nicolas Batum had, to me, even a worse tournament overall than Valanciunas. In this game, he played 18 minutes, 0 for 2 from the field, both of which were three-pointers. They really just do not put the ball in his hands at all. I've said for a long, long time that to solve, especially when you have a defensive force out there like Gobert, they need to just play him at the four. They could play Fournier, too, has some size, but obviously was not invited. We've lamented that many a time. And I think with Parker now kind of in the sunset, he's retired from the national team as well, does have a Eurobasket in 2013 to his credit. Diaw, you have to imagine this to be close to the last time that we'll see him also. And I think that actually it could be good for France now to move on to a new era where you just have DeColo and Hertel at point guard, start working Fournier in. They don't really have any other power forwards. Diaw doesn't provide quite enough stretch anymore, not enough defense the way he did when he was younger. And I think France could actually end up being a better team if they can kind of move on from Parker and Diaw. But, I have not been impressed with Vincent Collet the last couple of years after, they did win that 2013 Eurobasket and get the upset in Spain in the World Cup. The year after, just I think he's goes with a very traditional style, two bigs, not spacing the floor. And, these guys just can't score, and they have way too much talent for that. These guys play beautiful passing basketball in the NBA, and they can't do it in FIBA for whatever reason.
And something else in terms of Collet that concerns me is not Gobert, obviously, but some of the other rising young big men for France actually have decent jump shots. Jonathan John, from what I've seen, is all right. And Cornelis has a more reliable jump shot than I expected, though I actually liked it beforehand. And that's great. That's something in FIBA that can work really well, especially if they can protect the rim. But you need to have a coach and a system in place to use that, because if you don't, it doesn't provide value in that way, especially when those guys are too thin to do traditional big man stuff offensively. So they will need to maximize it. And also, they're going to need to develop some wings, because Cordonnier has a chance. He's more of a two, not a true wing in that sense. But they're going to need some of those guys to really...
Yeah, Luwawu would be another guy, presumably, who's played a little bit with them. I mean, I think with Fournier, if they actually start believing in Fournier and let him play, because he played too little even last year, too, even though he played very well for them. So with he and Batum, they should be good. I mean, and the reality is that wings and guards, they've got DeColo, they've still got Hertel, they've got Nikilatina, I think is how you pronounce his name, is coming in, who's going to be probably a lottery pick next year in the NBA. So they're going to have plenty of guards. They're going to have Gobert at center. They don't really have any good fours in the pipeline, unless you want to talk about Yabusele, who's not going to help these guys at all, given what we saw in Summer League. But it's probably enough on them. Look ahead to Spain and the U.S. now. What do you see as the keys to that game?
How long Coach K stays with the starting five, if it's something similar to what we saw? Because something I'd forgotten when we talked about it beginning, they played a lot better later in the game, but I believe the first seven shots Argentina took were all layups. And you can't do that against Spain, because Spain is a better team top to bottom, offensively, defensively, and you're not going to be able to spot them, that kind of a thing, unless everybody goes off. So I think the how they use the players and then the defense from that unit, because one of the things that was frustrating today, more so partially because they used DeAndre instead of Boogie, is how little it seems like the starters use their athleticism to really frustrate teams defensively. And then the other big question with this is going to be, will Coach K realize that he doesn't have to have Kyrie on the ball and he could put him, and granted, it's a lot harder against Spain because they use guys like Yule who are more dangerous than what they just faced in Argentina, but will they be able to like put Clay on the most dangerous guard for the other team and just let that happen?
Yeah, it's for Coach K, it's really, is it going to be Melo? Is it going to be Kyrie? Those guys have been two of their three best scorers in this tournament alongside Durant, who was unbelievable in this game. He had 27 points on 13 shots. Or is he going to go more with Paul George, more with Kyle Lowry, more with Jimmy Butler, get the trust that the offense is going to be able to score just fine when you have KD? Paul George is a great offensive player in his own right. If they're going to play Cousins, he's a very good offensive player as well. That's going to be the question. You imagine that he's going to default to Kyrie and Carmelo. We'll see whether they can stop anybody with that. I think the big variable is going to be Spain's three-point shooting. Nikola Mirotic was outstanding against France. When they would switch, he was able to duck in and get some nice hook shots right at the rim. 5 of 8 on threes. He was like doing the flyby fake and getting open. I think he shoots it so much better from the FIBA three-point line than he does even, you know, 2 feet back in the NBA. So I think how well he shoots it is going to be huge. How well guys like Yule and Sergio Rodriguez shoot it. Gasol is going to be able to get as many pick and pop threes as he wants. You know, Scola was able to get a ton of them, and he's just not a good enough shooter to make them. Gasol, we've seen him, he shoots 40% from FIBA 3-point range, and he's not at all reluctant to take them. So if Spain hits their threes, I foresee a very close game. If they can't hit their threes, and they're going to get plenty of them, I think, against this U.S. defense, unless they really are going to take their best defenders and play them a lot of the game, which I don't think they will. I don't think Spain is really going to be able to stop the U.S. that well. They never really have, particularly, and that was even when they had Mark and they had Ibaka. So it's looking like it's either going to be a shootout if Spain hits their threes, or I think the U.S., you know, could win it by 12 to 15 if Spain is a little cold. And they have, in these last couple of tournaments, struggled to hit their threes, but they've been making them lately, and that's been a huge difference for them.
One of my favorite phrases is the idea of a feedback loop, and I think that's going to be a huge story for the U.S. because we saw it in this game that when they started getting stops, they got much cleaner offensive looks, and they made those. And so that was a big fundamental change. And so that might not be with the starting five, whatever that ends up being, but it should happen at other points in the game. And Spain, you know, they hustle, but they don't necessarily have the greatest transition defenders. And I talked about where you assign Kyrie Irving. The other huge question with that will be, I assume that first of all, you want to move Melo off of Mirotic, just because I think that just wouldn't work. But will they put Durant on him? Because I think of the guys that they actually play, because that excludes Draymond Green, who's not really getting many minutes, KD's probably their best option.
Another thing to watch, too, will be these guys all know Rubio from the NBA. Teams have not guarded Rubio at all. He hit a couple in their game against Lithuania early that really opened things up for them. You imagine that he and Spain's defense is going to be a lot better if they can keep Rubio on the floor with Yule. If they go with Rodriguez, it could start to get pretty ugly defensively for them. So if Rubio can stay on the floor and the U.S. can effectively make him beat them, number one, with the proper communication and execution, which, you know, Kyrie is going to be on him, so we don't know about that or not, or whether it's going to be Rubio being forced to take shots and actually making shots. I think that's something to look at, too, because Spain has struggled to score at times with him on the floor for that reason.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching. And one thing I wanted to mention from the prior game, the Serbia-Australia game, is I think it'll be an awesome test for Jokic, because we've seen him in a lot of different formats, and whether he does as you've mentioned many times, and you're completely
right. Yeah, he got punked by their bigs in the first matchup.
Mm-hmm. So whether he can react to that, and also Australia's smalls are a little bit different in terms of when he gets that mismatch. I mean, Jokic will still kill those guys, but I want to see how he does. And that doesn't, I'm not super optimistic or pessimistic, I just want
to
see.
All right, before we move on to the best and worst contracts since the lockout, let's talk about Blue Apron. What have you been making lately?
So the standout recently was it was a salmon dish with a hoisin-based sauce, and it was flaked salmon, which I've actually never cooked before. So you cook it as a fillet, but then you do it.
We had that too. That was awesome, actually.
It was really, really good, and it had
with bok choy. Like the fried egg on top, right? Yeah.
I didn't have it with the fried egg on top because I'm not the biggest fan of that kind of egg, but it was awesome.
Yeah, my girlfriend really liked that one. She liked pretty much any kind of rice dish. Got a chicken tinga tacos that I'm actually going to make right after we're done recording. If you don't know what Blue Apron is, it is a food delivery service complete with recipes. They give you the exact amount of every ingredient that you need, so there's no food waste. You can do it twice a week or three times a week, and it's just a great way to cook together as a family, which is something we don't do enough as a society. Their research has shown that people who get Blue Apron take more time to actually cook together, to have dinner together. That's something that's really important for us since we're all really busy. I'm sure most of the smart people who listen to this podcast have really busy jobs and lives. And so with your significant other or your roommates or whoever, it's a great way to eat really healthily and with great, spectacular ingredients. That's probably really cheaper than it would be to get all this stuff if you went to a Whole Foods or something. So it just shows up right on your doorstep once a week. You put it in the fridge. You can make it throughout the week. It's really just a wonderful service. You can find out more about them at blueapron.com/capspace. You can get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to that blueapron.com/capspace. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So the way I wanted to go through this on the best and worst podcast, or best and worst podcasts in Salaka.
We can do that too.
Well, we're not on track to be one of the best so far, but hopefully we're going to improve a little bit here. We're basically just going to go through. We each picked two in both the good and bad category for each year, starting with 2011 through 2015. Probably hit on 2016 a little bit as well. But as with everything we do here, it's important to remember the context, right? Karl Anthony Towns and Anthony Davis were on great contracts, but that's because the system requires that be the case with the rookie scale. LeBron James has been on an awesome contract. You're not going to get any credit for signing LeBron James to a max contract that's artificially limited by the system when everyone knows that he's worth three times that amount on the open market. So I think when you look at contracts and guys who change teams, that's a good way to look at it. I think also we probably want to discount ring chaser type of contracts as well, because again, that's not, you basically already have a good team and you're just asking someone to come there. It's not like, oh, I saw something in this guy. We really negotiated incredibly well to get this guy. I mean, you deserve some credit there, but you know, Ray Allen going to the Heat for the mini mid-level, you're not getting a ton of credit for that from me. That's just a no-brainer, if you know what I mean.
Something else I want to mention is, for me, is the idea of surplus value, and that can be a positive or a negative. So that, for me, extends mostly to longer contracts. So that can be a bigger positive or a bigger negative. And another way that affects it is the situation in terms of things like bird rights. So an example I'll use, one of the better contracts was Kent Bazemore, because, you know, they got Kent Bazemore, but they did only have early bird rights, and so that changed the negotiations moving forward. And it's funny I mentioned Atlanta, because that'll actually come up with a few different Atlanta players. But, you know, if you can get a longer contract and it's good for the whole thing, that's awesome. And if you get if you have that for a negative contract, then that does it. And another kind of a rule that I think is good worth noting in your head is, if you had to buy somebody out, or if a team had to buy somebody out of years of that contract, it's probably going to make this list.
Yeah, it is. And another thing, too, is the sort of hometown discount, Dirk, Tim Duncan, Manu type of contracts. Again, I don't think those count as much. I mean, you do deserve some credit there for fostering the sort of culture to make guys want to do that to begin with. But I think it's hard to really kind of count those when everyone knows that the guy's just doing the organization a solid. It's not like you kind of guessed right. You picked the right guy to bet on and the right amount to bet on. So let's look at the 2011 offseason. Everyone will remember that this happened frantically in December. I think it was December 9th that the CBA was actually agreed to, and the season was going to start on Christmas. And people really just got a copy of the CBA, and then like 48 hours later, you're signing guys. And So I know a lot of executives basically had to lock themselves in a room and try to read everything in that time period. And it also was the case that there were some, just was not that good of a free agent class. Really a free agent class that was more typical, if you remember back, of the old CBAs, because contracts were longer, teams were at the cap. They also, extensions were easier to do. So just great players would much, much less likely to become free agents. And so when we talk about some of like the best and worst free agents that were available in 2011, you kind of remember how it used to be. Now with all these shorter contracts, the cap rising, we've had these crazy free agencies. Didn't used to be like that.
Yeah, it was a fundamental change that has certainly made our lives more exciting, but it really is harder in some ways for just the nature of things for there to be so much volatility. And yeah, and also want to mention the idea that this was not only, it was coming off the year that Miami formed, but Dallas won the title, because who wins the championship actually informs this quite a bit in terms of the worst contracts.
Yeah, so who is your first pick?
So my first pick will be a worst contract, if that's okay with you. And the reason why is Marcus Thornton, to me, is a great example of a specific type of bad contract. He was a restricted free agent because he'd only been in the league for 2 years. And he had only been on the Kings for part of that season. And he played really well for them. Credit, he was his first year, his rookie year, was age 22 season. So he was older than most guys. And he can score. The guy can get buckets. And even though, of course, this is, you know, much smaller salary cap, he got 5 years and $40 million. And that's just, that's even way too much money for him, like, now. And to get that then really did hamstring their situation. And I think that was really one of those, I talked about how duration matters to me. I think that's a great example on that end.
It's important to note, too, what the salary cap was in each of those years. For 2011-12, the cap was artificially set at $58 million. And then the next year, it was flat as well at $58 million. And then 2013-14, it only rose to $58.6 million. That's because the players took a haircut in that 2011 CBA. And so they had to freeze the cap, basically, until revenues went up enough that they were only making 50% or so of BRI. So we basically had 3 years in which the cap was very flat. And that Thornton contract, I actually didn't think that one was that bad at the time, because Thornton actually was coming off a pretty decent season. He was older than you might remember at the time. He had only played 2 years. He'd actually gotten traded from New Orleans to Sacramento that year. But he, in a Sacramento uniform, he played 27 games. He averaged 21 points, and he was relatively efficient. He had a 55 true shooting percentage, 18 PR for a 23-year-old guard. You felt like he was a young guy. He could at least be your third guard off the bench and really kind of light it up, be a Jamal Crawford type of guy who would actually would be relatively efficient. And the next year, he actually didn't drop off too badly. He shot 39% on threes, but he was injured. And then he really started to go downhill, so that by age 26, he really wasn't effective anymore. Ended up getting bought out. He's been bouncing around on minimum contracts for a while. That was one, just from a process standpoint, you felt like, okay, maybe they overpaid by, you know, a couple million a year. But, I mean, he was in sort of the same position that, like, a Tyler Johnson was at this point after coming off of his second year.
Yeah, and he got pretty close to the same money Tyler Johnson got in about half the salary cap. That's okay. Where do you want to go first?
Well, I thought that the worst contract was one that looked like it would haunt the Minnesota Timberwolves for a long time, and that was actually a maximum extension to Kevin Love. They, of course, got fantastic value from that. Love was an all-NBA player other than 2012-13 when he was injured. He was well worth that contract. The problem was that David Kahn wouldn't give him the full five-year max because he was saving it for Ricky Rubio under the designated player rule. And then he instead had to give Love a player option. So he only signed for 3 years. They could have had him for five. And then he really only played out 2 years of that extension in a Minnesota uniform because it didn't kick in until the 12-13 season. And then he ended up having to get traded to Cleveland. They got very lucky that LeBron went back to Cleveland, and Kahn, of course, was gone by that point, and they were able to get Andrew Wiggins in that deal, and then they were bad enough to get Karl Towns. So in a roundabout way, they actually turned out better because of this idea, but but it certainly wasn't because it was a great decision to only offer him 3 years instead of five.
Yeah, Love is a fascinating one in terms of that, because it was a bad contract in a counterintuitive way. I mean, he was their franchise for a couple of years, but making that kind of a decision, and the irony being that Ricky Rubio didn't end up getting a five-year contract anyway, so they held this out for him, and then he didn't end up being worth it. And so, and it also, I think that helped sour the relationship between player and team, which is a part of what made him really available in that sense. I mean, it would have been a little bit different, I think, if they had a more amicable thing then, and also they would have, of course, had longer team control. So it worked out splendidly for them in a counterintuitive way, but it was in terms of surplus value, they left a lot on the table theoretically before the trade.
My next one for the good, and it's interesting to talk about. I think probably the best player who actually changed teams via free agency was Tyson Chandler, and that's only because the Mavs didn't want to pay him. They tried to hold open space to get Deron Williams, which didn't work out for them, but probably actually did because they didn't sign him to that contract. And Chandler was actually ended up being probably worth his contract. I think he signed for like 4 years and $58 million with the Knicks. But the one I wanted to look at was Marc Gasol. This was actually the Rockets offering him what was the max at the time, 4 years, $55 million. Crazy to think that that was the max a mere 5 years ago for someone of his experience level.
Yeah, Chandler Parsons gets close to making, he makes more than that in 3 years and somewhat close in two.
Yeah, and the Grizzlies match it. Remember, 2011 had been the year that they actually were the eighth seed. They upset San Antonio, and it seemed like a lot for Gasol. I think people were surprised that Houston offered him that much, but obviously a great match for Memphis, and he ended up being well worth that contract. I mean, the only thing you could say is that Memphis maybe should have just offered him the five-year max, but, you know, I think with it being restricted free agency, with there not being that many teams out there at the time that had space, they probably played that the right way.
Along those lines, I'll go with another one that was a good match, and I kind of want this to have honors in two different ways, and that's the DeAndre Jordan contract. And so, if you want to read me at my angriest, go back and read some of my Real GM pieces at the time about the Warriors, because the DeAndre Jordan situation, again, we're talking about this constricted timeline due to the lockout, was some of the worst decisions this organization has made, even in the last decade, much less, you know, of the Lakers era. And it started with the Charlie Bell amnesty. So they burned their chip on Charlie Bell, who had just had, a DUI. He only had 1 year remaining on his contract.
$3.4 million or something in that range.
So they did that. And then they also, before they saw him play after the lockout, because there was that separation between players and teams, they cut Jeremy Lin to add just a little bit more salary to the DeAndre Jordan offer sheet. And the reason why that's so bad is everyone and their mother knew the Clippers were going to match it, because it was a reasonable value. It was a decent bet on a guy who was extremely talented. The Clippers didn't really have a ton of other options long-term at the center position. And so the Clippers ended up, even with those little moves to raise the price, ended up getting a really good deal on DeAndre Jordan. 4 years, $43 million.
The reason I hated that so much was because then they couldn't use the amnesty on Biedrins later.
Or David Lee.
And if you felt like you needed a new center that you had to pay eight figures to, and this is eight figures, that's a quarter of the, or this is almost a quarter of the cap, this contract, or a fifth of the cap, why wouldn't you just amnesty the center you already had who was making eight figures instead of wasting it on $3.4 million worth of salary? They could have actually upped the offer to Jordan too if they wanted to. That ended up costing them a first-round pick when they had to trade Biedrins to Utah in the 2013 offseason to open up space for Iguodala. That actually ended up working out fine. It wasn't the end of the world, but it really made no sense at the time. And I don't know that it was really that obvious for the Clippers to match at that point, because remember, this wasn't the Clippers that we remember at that point. They traded for Chris Paul shortly thereafter this, and Jordan had been a second-round pick. He hadn't really even necessarily been starting. And even the first couple of years that he was on the team, Vinny Del Negro, because he was scared of his free throw shooting down the end of the games, wouldn't even play him down the stretch. So, but it ended up obviously being an excellent contract, and now DJ is a max player. So I think the Marcus Thornton restricted free agency, that didn't work out on kind of an unproven player, and DeAndre Jordan, that one did, you know. But I think when you're taking a risk on somebody, doing it for a young guy in restricted free agency kind of makes a lot more sense, especially back then when resources were really more finite. Were there any other ones you wanted to talk about here, just maybe in passing? I think those are my those would be probably the nominees in each side.
There are a couple more on the good side just in passing. These aren't ones that I would consider real nominees. But Shane Battier taking 3 years at the mini-mid level was massive for Miami. I mean,
yeah,
it was.
They don't win those championships without him.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit in the ring chaser realm just because I'm sure he could have gotten more money somewhere else. But that was surplus value is huge there. And it was maybe like
$2 million or so under market for him at that point. He was probably the sort of player who maybe could have gotten the full MLE somewhere and just went for the mini-mid level. The taxpayer mid-level instead.
And considering he inspired one of my favorite terms in the sense, Nene signing for what ended up inspiring the Nene test, where he signed this 5-year deal with Denver, and then within that first season, they ended up trading him for JaVale McGee, which means that they traded him to an extension, which was pretty lucrative at the time, but the other team saw it as a value. I mean, we could talk about how that turned out in terms of JaVale.
It wasn't an extension. It was actually just he was a free agent.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's why, I apologize for my inaccurate phrasing. But so that was notable in the sense of getting a guy who was established in the league, paying him, and still being able to get an asset right then, because as we've seen, you know, that isn't always true with contracts. On the negative side, I want to mention Caron Butler.
Well, so let me ask you this. Did Nene at the time, he passed the Nene test for
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. That's what inspired it, was that he was a net asset. He was a net asset immediately after or shortly after signing his contract, which is impressive.
Yeah, although then they had to get McGee, who will appear on this list a little bit later. Some other notable ones I had for the bad. Tayshaun Prince at age 31, a 4-year, $28 million deal with Detroit. Chuck Hayes for the full MLE in Sacramento. He basically was useless for them that entire time. Caron Butler, 3 years, $24 million. That happened after the Chris Paul trade. That I think he spent 2 years, either 1 or 2 years. I think it was 2 years in Clipperland and didn't really do the greatest job. Started off really their difficulties.
There's the spillover thing that we have to talk about, which is that the getting out of his contract, it ended up facilitating the J.J. Redick thing, is that part of that was giving up Eric Bledsoe. So, you know, that's another way that contract ended up hurting them.
Yeah, and really, this is a point that cap analysts had been making going back to the prior CBA. Most contracts that were the full MLE for 4 years ended up looking really bad under the old CBA when it could be 5 years, or even gulp when it was 6 years in the CBA before that. And so you had some really bad ones there. Jason Richardson in Orlando, he might have been worth it if he hadn't gotten hurt. Big Baby in Orlando as well. That was sort of the beginning of the end for the Dwight Howard era, those signings that didn't really work out. Chuck Hayes, we mentioned. J.J. Barea in Minnesota. Richard Hamilton in Chicago. Really, all of those ended up looking pretty darn bad. But those were kind of the only ways that those teams had to add anybody. But there just weren't that many good free agents on the market to take that money. And nobody had cap space at those points because the cap just wasn't rising at all.
Yeah, that's an important point to consider in all this. Before we move on, one of the other things we want to do with this, Nate's already alluded to his, but is talking about contracts that we were wrong on, where, you know, they ended up in hindsight ending up in a different category. And the one I want to point to is Thaddeus Young. I've never been the biggest Thaddeus Young fan. Pacers fans are mad about that this summer. And he signed a 5-year, $43 million contract. And I just thought it was too much for him at that point. And considering where his career went and everything else, that was definitely a good contract.
Yeah, for me, there really wasn't that much either way. I mean, I really disliked most of those MLE contracts. I really hated the Prince one at the time. He got kind of bounced around at slots. I mean, he was already 31 when that was agreed to. Butler was 31 when his was agreed to. So I guess Thornton would be the one for me. I thought, that might have been a slight overpay, it was the Kings. They already had been bad for 5 years at that point. It was homegrown talent that they wanted to keep. And I thought he would at least work out as like a solid third guard. And I think he was before he just started struggling with injuries. If he had just continued to play at the level that he had as a 23 and 24-year-old throughout the life of that contract, not even talking about the improvement that you would have expected, he probably would have been, if not worth that contract, reasonably close to it.
Do you want to take the first pick for 2012?
Yeah, this one is one that's going to go into the pot for being right up there as one of the worst ones when we finally pick which ones we want to settle on. Landry Fields, a 3-year, $20 million offer sheet after a couple of good years with the Knicks. Actually, was it only 1 year?
I think it was
that
1 year.
That after his rookie year. And the impetus for that was Steve Nash was a free agent in Phoenix. Toronto was worried that he was going to go to the Knicks. And what they decided to do was sign Fields to this exorbitant contract, which then, in theory, would force the Knicks to match, meaning that they would have no space for Steve Nash, which would mean that Steve Nash would come there. A lot of those assumptions turned out to be incorrect, and Landry Fields being a semi-decent player also ended up being incorrect.
I think it might be one of the worst process signings in the recent history of the NBA, just because the whole thing was so convoluted, and the idea of signing somebody to an above-value contract in this way was completely ludicrous. I have to note, though, that it was 2 years. It wasn't one. He had been on the Knicks for 2 years and had been the starter for both years.
Yeah, but he was someone who had been drafted in the second round in 2010, and just randomly his rookie year had shot 39% on three-pointers. The next year, in 66 games, he shot 26% on three-pointers. The year after that, in 51 games, he shot 14% on three-pointers. He was 2 out of 14. And then the 2 years after that, he only played 30 and 26 games. Some of that was injury. He only scored under 400 points, basically, in a Raptors uniform for his entire time. And they paid him $21 million. And it really hurt them. You remember in that 2013-14 season, the first year that they made the playoffs, they desperately needed somebody to guard Joe Johnson in that playoff series. They dusted him off. And, of course, he couldn't do anything on offense. They didn't even guard him. And he wasn't much better trying to guard Joe Johnson either. And it was really just one of the worst miscalculations that you'll see, and probably something along with the Bargnani extension and the Rudy Gay trade that led to Brian Colangelo's demise in Toronto.
Yeah, that one is magnificent in a negative way. To me, the front runner in terms of positive is the Serge Ibaka extension. And that was one that looked to me really good at the time and only aged better, because Ibaka, especially younger Serge Ibaka, was really a unicorn in terms of a guy who could impact the game defensively at the power forward position. He hadn't really added the range to his jump shot at that point, and him taking substantially less than he could have gotten on the open market if he had waited a year helped them stay reasonably cost effective during that time, even as they started paying their players. And so Ibaka, while, you know, guys, you know, signing for extensions can be a little bit different, him taking so much less, it was a great contract, and he's still on it now, and it's still a great contract.
Yeah, well, he'll get his lost value back in this free agency, I assume, if he can stay healthy. This offseason actually had some real howlers in terms of the bad ones. Gerald Wallace was one of those. You recall that Billy King compounded the error that he made in trading the number 6 pick for Wallace, and then gave him a 4-year, $40 million contract in free agency. Wallace basically had one good year left where he was even in the rotation, and then essentially was dead salary after that. He got traded to Boston in that horrible trade where they had to dump a bunch of salary, and he actually, that contract still expired with basically 3 years of playing very, very little. And, of course, Deron Williams also signed his max extension, which everybody and their brother would have done at the time. But he really then had two good years and essentially fell off a cliff after that. So those two Nets contracts that really set the stage for then that trade with the Celtics the year after. And now, of course, have set the stage for this hell that they're in, where they won't have control over their own draft pick until 2019. And, of course, they haven't been any good for some time and don't project to be either.
The contract that I'll count as the one that I was really wrong on was also one of the worst contracts in hindsight, and that's JaVale McGee. So McGee had a lot of potential. I was obsessed with his ceiling, and while I understood his foibles as a player and his catastrophically low basketball IQ, giving him 4 years and $44 million seemed okay. You know, it seemed tolerable, palatable. And not only did they have to give it away, they had to give up firsts to give it away. And it was one of actually the last contracts where that was really notable to do as a pure salary dump.
Yeah, and doing some of the research for this podcast, I came across the news era on his new contract and restricted free agency. Denver obviously knew that they're going to have to pay him when they traded away Nene to get him. Keeping Nene obviously would have been a far better idea in retrospect. They probably beat Golden State the following year if they still have Nene. Denver had no big men who could play in that series defensively. And when I came across the newser, it was justified with a quote from George Karl after the Lakers series. Because you remember he had these two monster games against the Lakers in the 2012 playoffs. I think that was a six-game series. And George Karl said, "I've never seen anyone like him before. I've never coached anyone like him. He has the moves of a 6'6 guy." And then JaVale actually, you know, I mean, he had like a 20 PR that year. The next year, he also had a 20 PR. And then the year after that, I mean, it's important to remember that this contract wouldn't look nearly as bad if he hadn't gotten injured. He only played 5 games the year after that, the first year of the Brian Shaw era. And he played 23 games the year after that and 34 games last year. And now he's a Warrior, of course. So a lot of this was health related. I think that while it was an overpay, it was probably too much to expect that someone with sort of his history from a teammate standpoint and from a basketball IQ standpoint could be a steady starter, which is what he was going to be paid by as. You know, I agree. This one wasn't that bad. And he, you know, they got some good stuff out of him that first year when they won, you know, 57 games with him playing a reasonably large role.
So a little bit of history, just I think I'm remembering this right. So Jeff Green signed that contract. That was after, right after his heart condition was discovered, right?
He missed the entire year. So I think what happened was he was traded for Kendrick Perkins in the 2011-12 season. And no, I'm sorry, that was the 2010-11 season that he got traded. And then he had the heart condition during the lockout year and wasn't able to play at all. Then he was signed to a 4-year, $36 million contract the year after that. I always suspected that there was an element of either they sort of had a wink-wink agreement there when he got traded for Kendrick Perkins in 2011, or that they felt like they just needed to look good, kind of doing right by him the year afterwards. That was a deal that wasn't horrendous, but Green really never matured into a starter-level player, despite putting up some superficial stats in Boston once all their good players left. And then maybe you could say it was a good trade because they actually got that protected first that's looking like one of the better one of the better assets out there. So maybe it was a good contract to sign into that because at least someone else was willing to take him on it.
Yeah, then that's kind of the reverse of the Maurice Spates contract, and people have kind of forgotten about it, that the contract before the one he signed with the Warriors, it was 2 years, $8 million from what I recall, and that was so egregious that he had to be dumped to Cleveland, and then that is one of the other picks that is out.
Yeah, that's the one that's top five protected this year.
It was originally double-sided.
Yeah, it was now it's gone down to top five protected, but it was, and part of the reason for that was they just wanted to avoid the tax. This is one of the original tax avoidance trades where that made me write a piece saying that the luxury tax was actually bad for small markets because even just being a couple million in the tax, they just couldn't do it, whereas the rich teams could, and they gave up a first rounder to avoid the tax. It ended up being that they're able to dump Rudy Gay later, and they wouldn't have even had to trade Spates to avoid the tax. And they also were worried about the next year, but he actually opted out of the second year, and he ended up signing a 3-year, $9 million deal with Golden State in that 2013 offseason. But yeah, that was one that didn't look great. Spates was a restricted free agent. He had been a favorite of John Hollinger's. Just, you know, he had pretty good stats in Hollinger's metrics back early on, and then he went there in 2012, and they ended up trading for him. And then they traded for Luer, who was another John Hollinger favorite, and looked pretty good for a short time, but then ended up ultimately not being a huge entity there. So just because it forced them to make that trade to give up a first rounder, yeah, that Spates one was pretty ugly. What did we have on the good side for that year? Because we're such positive people.
This was actually a great year for extensions. So Danilo Gallinari got 4 years, $42 million. That worked out really well. Drew Holiday, 4 years, $41 million, which is one of it actually worked out so well that beyond the lack of disclosure of the stress fractures, the Sixers were actually able to get 2 first round picks for him before he started that extension. It was in that time between when it was agreed to and when it kicked in. And I would say Taj Gibson worked out well too, 4 years, $38 million.
Yeah, people still actually debate whether he was worth it. He never really started, but in 2013-14 and 2012-13 and 2013-14, he was definitely a starter-level player. Should have been starting over Carlos Boozer by that point, but just kind of wasn't for whatever reason. Another great contract was Danny Green, who in 2012 shot 44% on three-pointers, was getting to the point where he was playing pretty good defense already, and then he ended up signing with San Antonio for 3 years and a little over $11 million at that point, coming back for what ended up being a massive discount. And then he took another massive discount at 4 years, $40 million, when that expired in the summer of 2015. So that was just another great one by the Spurs, whether they just convinced him to stay or nobody else really made a good enough offer for him, whatever it was. I mean, he still would have been a restricted free agent at that point with only 3 years of service. Someone still should have given him a better offer than that. But again, that was the time when there wasn't really that much cap space that was out there, and the Spurs were able to leverage that into getting a great deal, basically a starter for $3.5 million a year.
And because they're demons, that wasn't even the only guy the Spurs signed that offseason who makes this list twice as a free agent, because Patty Mills signed a two-year, $2.2 million deal with them, which set the table for another ridiculous deal, and they got just a lot of value. I mean, he ended up being more of a contributor a little bit later on, but just to have him around at that price is spectacular.
Yeah, that year he had basically washed out of the league almost. He played a couple of years in Portland. He shot very well on threes that year in 2012. Remember, that was the year that the Spurs had the 20-game winning streak and then had it broken, lost four straight to Oklahoma City and didn't make the finals. They looked like they were going to be a juggernaut and were going to match up with Miami that year. So again, they were able to get Mills, who ended up being really their primary backup point guard for the next few years. And then they brought him back again after that, after the 2014 season, helped by the fact that he had shoulder surgery. Some other good ones during that time, Jan Mahinmi for 4 years, $16 million. That was pretty good. You mentioned the Ibaka extension. The one that I was most wrong on was a restricted free agent offer sheet to Goran Dragic from Phoenix. He had finished the year in Houston. I actually wrote that Morey had done well to let him go, and that probably turned out to be the case because the next year they were able to get Dwight Howard with that extra space. But it was 3 years or 4 years, $30 million, the fourth-year player option, which eventually allowed him to get traded from Phoenix to Miami, the threat of that, and then really cash in. But I thought that was going to be a bad contract, and it very quickly turned into a good contract, not even because the market changed, but just because Dragic really, really improved, especially in that 2013-14 season.
Yeah, that one turned out really well. And two other ones that both involved the then Hornets in different ways was that they let Robin Lopez, the whole Robin Lopez thing, so they had let him go in a prior year because of stupid reasons. And he signed 3 years, $15 million with the Blazers, which was turned out to be a spectacular contract. And then they did get Ryan Anderson from the Orlando Magic in what was technically a sign and trade, but it really wasn't, for 4 years, $34 million. Both those worked out spectacularly for their teams.
And we would be remiss in not mentioning Ray Allen going to the Heat at age 37 from the Celtics, turning down more money from the Celtics to go to the Heat for 2 years, the mini mid-level, basically 2 years, $6.2 million, and obviously hit one of the greatest shots in NBA history. So again, that sort of falls more into the ring chaser category. I wouldn't pick it, but certainly one that has to be talked about at that point. What else do we have on the bad side? There are quite a few other ones.
So there are a couple that I think you can group together on that they just really didn't work out. Like, you know, maybe it was, and so for me, that starts with Steve Nash. That was a contract that, of course, was much ballyhooed at the time. 3 years, $25 million, and the sign-and-trade cost them two first-round picks. It probably could not have worked out worse for the Lakers in terms of how things worked out. And then the other one, earmuffs, Kevin Pelton. Brandon Roy with the Timberwolves. He signed a two-year deal, the mid-level. Fortunately, the second year was non-guaranteed. He played in five games as a Timberwolf.
Yeah, that was a year when everything went totally wrong for Minnesota. Love, I think, missed like 60 games, broke his hand a couple of times.
Was that the knuckle push-ups?
Yes. Yeah, well, that was the first time, and then he broke it again, like when someone like slapped his hand or something. At least they made the second year that non-guaranteed. A couple other ones that were really ugly. Eric Gordon, who was always going to get matched because he had been part of the Chris Paul trade the previous winter, got a four-year max offer sheet from Phoenix, 4 years, $58 million, with a fourth-year player option that ended up getting matched by New Orleans. They had to basically match it. Gordon was always disgruntled. He had a lot of comments at the time about how he just wished that he could have gone to Phoenix. Why didn't they just let him go? He didn't want to be in New Orleans. And he largely played like that and also really suffered from a ton of injuries. Never was the player and fulfilled the promise that got him to be the centerpiece of that trade, really, to begin with. And then another one that I was wrong on, that actually started off as kind of a bad contract and ended up being a good contract, was George Hill. When he got traded for Kawhi Leonard in 2011, they extended him, and I can't remember if they extended him or whether it was a free agent contract, but it was 5 years, $40 million, and that looked at it for a time like he was sort of an albatross. I think we grew to appreciate his game more, and also the cap went up as time went on, and now that is a value contract for him at $8 million a year. He's just finishing that up next summer.
One we have to mention, just because it'll eventually complete a troika, is Jason Thompson to the Kings. 5 years, $34 million for another power forward, and the last year of that was partially guaranteed, and he was a guy who ended up getting not only traded to dump that contract, in my opinion, the worst trade since the lockout, but also got dumped again. So that's just kind of the way it worked out.
Yeah, the saving grace was that the last year was only $2.65 million guaranteed, and that actually got stretched by the Warriors to give themselves enough room to get Kevin Durant. Another one that really started things off, a guy who just was everyone's favorite mistake, Nick Young. This was after the year after Philly had actually made it to the semifinals of the Eastern Conference and lost a seven-game series to the Celtics. It was kind of unclear who their GM was. The discussion was that Doug Collins was kind of in charge, and they gave Nick Young 1 year, $8 million to come over from the Clippers, and they really did pretty horribly that year, ended up winning like 34 games, and that's what led Sam Hinkie to come in and Drew Holiday to end up getting traded.
Yeah, massive.
All right, we'll do one more year and then call it quits here. In 2013, probably you would have to say a big candidate for the best contract on this list, Steph Curry, 4 year, $44 million extension in the fall of 2013, still comes over the 2013 offseason.
And as somebody who was covering the team at the time, I do have to note that it was not clean cut at the time. He had just come off these ankle injuries, though it must also be noted that those were a little bit overhyped because they forced the surgery a little bit early. Not forced, that's a little bit dramatic, because they wanted to tank to get the pick that became Harrison Barnes. And so they shut him down early. And so then that kind of added to the injury prone thing because he missed a lot of games. But that is the best non-rookie contract in the league still, and facilitated everything else. And on that contract, he already won back-to-back MVPs. And while I don't think he's going to win a third this year, he certainly could.
That was one. The other one I would look at as being awesome that no one really thought was good at the time, Timofey Mozgov with Denver. He really had been out of the rotation in the year that they lost to the Warriors and won 57 games. He barely played in that series, and he would like start a few games here and there, as I recall. 3 years and $14 million. The reason that ended up being such a great contract was that they then traded him a year and a half later to Cleveland and got two first rounders in the deal, which was awesome.
One of which was the aforementioned Spates one.
Right, and that was actually that wasn't just like, hey, Cleveland's first rounder that's going to be like number 26. Although at the time of that trade, they were like 500, so it was looking pretty ugly for them. People forget that with them having made two finals after this and making it look easy in the East playoffs, like how ugly their struggles really were for those first 40 games of the second LeBron James era. But yeah, Mozgov started playing like a starting center, really in what was a very rough first summer for when they fired George Karl. They gave out a couple other pretty bad contracts as well for Tim Connelly, because you remember Ujiri left at the same time in 2013 as well. That Mozgov contract was a bright spot, despite the fact that they actually let Kosta Kufos go to Memphis. We were sort of saying, why would you let Kufos go? He's better than Mozgov at the time. Like, why didn't you just give Kufos that contract? That turned out to be wrong. Mozgov turned out to be better than Kufos and got them that awesome trade deal with Cleveland. So that's both one that I was wrong on and one that turned out to be a really, really good contract in that offseason.
There's a group that I think has to be discussed together because they were all signed by the same team. And it might be the best threesome of contracts signed by the same team in the same summer. Paul Millsap, Kyle Korver, Damari Carroll, all signed by the Hawks. Two of them were new additions, had not been on the team. Millsap, 2 years, $19 million. Damari Carroll, 2 years, $5 million. Kyle Korver, 4 years, $24 million.
Just, no, Korver actually had finished the previous year.
Right,
with
he's
them,
the one. The other two, two were new additions. He was not.
Okay.
And so, but getting those guys for that money is absolutely incredible.
One of the trends that you see here is that 2011, it was hard to find good ones or a lot of bad ones. 2012, probably still more bad ones than good ones. And now with 2013, a lot of this was helped by the fact that the cap ended up rising as well, though there are still some really bad ones in here, cap rising or no. But it just, it became a lot easier to give out good contracts or contracts that really, you know, were market rate at the time. Just getting a good player on a market rate salary starting in 2013, if it was a longer term deal, started to really work out because the cap then began to go up. I mean, this was the last year that it was kind of steady. And then 2014, it went up to 63. 2015 was 70. And then, of course, this year it was 94.
And so those guys, all, of course, massive parts of the Hawks' success. And another guy who was a new addition, who was a huge part of his team's success, is J.J. Redick. Redick, whose deal was almost famously nixed by Donald Sterling, signed a four-year, about $28 million contract and has been an underrated, unsung part of what makes the Clippers so good.
Yeah, he really has been. The one downside to that contract was that they invested resources on the wing with someone who wasn't going to be a defensive stopper. But still, I mean, once they got him, they really just took off as being one of the best offenses in the league. I think we can count on them to even still to be that again this year. And Redick was 29 at that point. That was a fair deal for him, but he has aged incredibly well. He probably had the best year of his career last year.
And he's gotten so much better defensively too.
Yeah, that was something too. The Clippers also brought back Matt Barnes at 3 years, $9 million that year, which was a contract that really worked out pretty well for them. He started for them for 2 years at $3 million a year and was totally adequate. One that I was definitely wrong about was the DeMarcus Cousins extension. They gave him a four-year max in October. And in retrospect, they probably should have just given him the five-year max. We thought, hey, just make him prove that he can behave. And he actually took his game to a new level that year, played much better. You know, he still has a lot of problems in Sacramento, and I don't mean to gloss over those, but he definitely got better after they gave him that extension. And then with the cap going up, I mean, that's still one of the good value contracts in the league. And the other benefit of that, too, having extended him instead of waiting until he was a restricted free agent, is now they actually will have the ability earlier, starting this October, to renegotiate and extend him should they so choose. They probably won't have space to do it this year, but maybe they could next year if they can actually work it out and get an environment that he wants to stay in.
Or in some ways, maybe more accurately, he can do that with another team because it's the anniversary of when he signed the contract. So we'll see. And another extension that has to be mentioned is Derek Favors. I think that's one that more worked out better than thought at the time. I thought it was.
I thought that was a steal at the time.
Yeah,
awesome.
Apparently you liked him more than I did. I mean, I liked Favors, but I didn't love him, and it's worked out splendidly for them, and that's part of the reason why I think he's such a good renegotiation and extension contract or possibility now, just to lock him in at a more reasonable rate. A
couple other ones. Jeff Teague was signed to a four-year, $32 million offer sheet pretty late in the free agency process by Milwaukee. Atlanta ended up matching that. Whatever you think of Teague, he clearly has been that good, and he had that all-star season in 2014-15. I mean, Atlanta basically built the bones of that 60-win team a year later in that offseason. Really, you have to look at it as, just from in terms of a contract standpoint, definitely up there with one of the best off-seasons that we've seen. And then a couple other small ones, Andre Iguodala, that sign and trade that took all those gyrations from the Warriors, giving up two first-round picks, dumping $24 million in salary, a four-year, $48 million contract for him that, again, was market rate at the time. You worried about him at age 29, how he was going to age. He is taking care of himself pretty well. Avoided injury, was finals MVP, part of the greatest regular season team of all time. You'd have to say that one worked out.
Certainly did. Oh, and also I would give credit to another defensive aging player, Tony Allen, 4 years, $20 million. I think that's worked out well for Memphis. I mean, he has his limitations, but a big part of their identity at a very cheap price.
Yeah, that was one that I had kind of worried about at the time, but it ended up actually looking just fine. So there are really some awesomely bad contracts that were given out in that 2013 offseason. Where do you want to start here? I'm very interested to see what you're going to pick, because there are like probably five of these that are, you could argue, other than Landry Fields and Gerald Wallace, are probably the worst of the ones that we've discussed so far.
I'll start with Josh Smith. Josh Smith, 4 years.
He got stretched less than a year and a half into this contract.
Less than a year and a half into his contract, and he was put into an unwinnable situation because they signed him for 4 years and $56 million to play small forward next to Greg Monroe and Andre Drummond. And that is just disastrous. Like, it's one of those, it looked bad at the time. You knew it was going to be bad. I don't think any of us could have seen how disastrous it would be. And then, of course, it ended up being compounded that not only was he stretched, but he was probably stretched a little bit hastily by Stan Van Gundy, which led to, or his GM name, which I can't remember right now, because, you know, he got in that situation and just wanted to get out of it. And so it's now this, you know, mid-level exception level kind of albatross around their neck for another few years.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. I mean, they're going to be paying him through, what, like 2020 or something like that? It's really pretty remarkable. And it was just, that was one, I still remember the tweet that I sent out as soon as that came across Twitter, sitting in my office. It was just, oh no, that's all I tweeted. And I mean, that's probably the one that I had the most visceral negative reaction to at the time.
It wasn't
and
the Smith, one for me.
I thought that Smith, I mean, there's another one coming up too, but I thought that Smith actually, that wasn't that bad for him at the time. I think he was 28. I thought his athleticism was going to really decline. That turned out to be the case. But I thought that a team signing him to play at the four would do okay. But it was just, yeah, putting him next to Monroe and Drummond just made no sense at all. And Smith, I mean, you have to imagine he's going to be out of the league now at this point. He still has another year left on that contract. He would have had another year, and he's pretty much replacement level.
He made more on the first year of that contract than Carroll and Millsap combined with the Hawks.
Well, yeah, that's the amazing part of this, right, is that the Hawks, who had such a good offseason, decided to just let him go, and then that they were able to sign such better players to replace him. I mean, I think at the time, in this offseason of 2013, I think probably 75-80% of people would have said that Josh Smith was better than Paul Millsap at that point. And Millsap, I mean, was coming off a non-playoff year, I think, with the Jazz. He was sort of a starter. He was considered a defensive liability, which he certainly improved a ton since he was attending Hawks University. See, I mean, Millsap's, the way that he improved starting at, I think he was 28 when he signed that contract, he's had one of the great late career blossomings of any player in NBA history.
So I'll do the one now that made me the most viscerally angry since you just led that with yours. Kobe's extension. Because what that meant to me, while I understand the, if you want to call it the obligation part of it, it guaranteed that the Lakers were not going to be relevant for the subsequent years. And that was, as somebody who was living in LA for some of their good years, seeing that was disheartening in a lot of different ways. And I mean, we didn't expect him to fall off the way that he did, you know, with everything that happened, but that took them out of relevance for a while, and now I think we're seeing that extend longer than anyone expected.
He was already making $30 million a year and was coming off the torn Achilles. He wasn't even healthy yet,
right,
when that contract extension was signed. And, you know, considering his age, I mean, I think it was his 35 and 36 seasons that the extension covered. It basically prevented them, if he had been making less, maybe they could have tried to get two guys. You know, they could have maybe gotten Carmelo and gotten one other guy, but instead it was just only Carmelo basically joining a team that had nobody. He wasn't interested in that. And they tried to get LaMarcus and DeAndre the year after that, but they didn't. They only, again, had one max slot because Kobe was taking up so much, so they couldn't get anyone there. And then their whole thought was, oh, well, you know, we'll just get in on 2016 when he retires or when this extension ends. But they were so bad those 2 years, even with the draft picks they were able to get from that, luckily, given the fact that they had some protected picks that were out there, they still weren't able to get anybody good this year either. And it's really looking like so far away for the Lakers And they've also now compromised any dreams that they had in 2017 of getting two impact players. So it is just so far away from relevance. And whatever you want to say about, okay, we have to take care of Kobe, that we're loyal, that's going to help us get free agents. Well, I don't know what the counterfactual is there. If they kind of tried to squeeze him a little bit, whether he would have left, but if they could have gotten more players or what have you. But I do know what did happen, and what was is that they haven't been able to get any free agents, whether they were loyal to Kobe Bryant or not. And so you have to say that that just unequivocally is one of the worst contracts in NBA history, taking a franchise that had been at the pinnacle of the league now to basically, you know, so far away from the end of the tunnel that you can't even see it yet, 60 points in his last game or not.
From a team that had light at the end of the tunnel to a team that never really did, Carl Landry to the Kings, that was a contract that I knew was bad from the second it was signed. I like Carl a lot. I got to cover him a little bit when he was in Oakland. But 4 years, $26 million was way too much for him. He duplicated so much of what Sacramento already had in their power forwards and didn't need what he brought, and ended up being a part of the worst trade, in my opinion, since the lockout, other than the Harden trade, maybe.
Yeah, the worst part was he couldn't even be healthy there, too, so they didn't even get anything out of him when he was there. But this was just a fundamental, this one is right up there for me. Not that many, not that much money, but it was at least just a fundamental misunderstanding. Remember, this is the first summer that Vivek was in there. He hired Mike Malone first, then he hired Pete D'Alessandro as the GM afterwards, and he had been the big savior to keep them in Sacramento, and he was going to revolutionize the NBA, but you're probably not going to do that with contracts like this. He felt like this is the sort of contract you do when you're already a playoff team to try to put you over the top, and they weren't anywhere close to the playoffs, and Carl Landry sure as heck wasn't going to help them playing next to DeMarcus Cousins, another sort of wide body guy who doesn't shoot threes either.
And they already had Jason Thompson, of course, and I think they'd already moved on from Chuck Hayes at that point, but yeah, I mean, jeez.
Yeah, I think they still had Chuck Hayes on the team. But yeah, they just signed Jason Thompson, the extension the previous year. They decided he wasn't good enough, but Landry wasn't really that much of an upgrade. I mean, it's sort of doing the same thing that Detroit is doing at backup center now, where you sign a guy to a lot of money that you think is going to solve the problem. And then, or Orlando, what they're doing with their backup point guards right now. You sign a guy 1 year who's not that good for too much money to solve the problem. He doesn't solve the problem. And then you sign another guy for too much money the next year. And before you know it, you've got like three guys at that position, and they're making more than starter money, and you don't even have one good solution to your actual problem.
And another story with a lot of those guys, with DJ Augustine and with Carl Landry, is the years issue. Giving Landry 4 years at that price made it even worse. If it had been three, it would have been a lot more palatable.
Yeah, again, too, another common theme here is that there were teams that let these guys go, right? Jarrett Jack is another guy who wasn't a great contract. He signed in Cleveland for the full MLE for 4 years, though the last year was $1 million guaranteed. That's just ending right now. And the Warriors let those two guys go, despite having what had been by far the best season in their history, getting to the playoffs, pushing San Antonio in the second round. You would think that a lot of organizations would say, oh my God, we have to keep these guys together. And instead they said, no, we're going to let these guys go. And then they went after Iguodala and got him. But even so, they weren't going to re-sign Jack and Carl Landry. They realized that those guys were reserves, they're going to be too expensive, and it just wasn't worth it. If they had re-signed those guys, where would they be today? You know, they probably would have never won a championship if they decided to bring those guys back. So to a team that really could have made a big mistake at that point, avoided it, and that was huge. I think a lot of Warriors fans at the time were really lamenting the loss of those two guys.
I feel like now's a good time to talk about Minnesota's summer.
Yeah. Yeah, this one was really a disaster. Again, something that led to the departure of Kevin Love, which, as we talked about, ended up being okay. But this was essentially, Love at this point had 2 years left, so they knew they had to improve. They had some space. They got a sign and trade of Kevin Martin from Oklahoma City, 4 years, $27 million with a fourth year player option. He ended up getting bought out. Chase Budinger, 3 for 15, had already had some knee problems, ended up just getting dumped for nothing to the Pacers at the end of this year. And he's really, you know, hanging on to his NBA career by a thread at this point. And then Nikola Pekovic, as he restricted free agent in like August. They gave him 5 years, $60 million. We didn't quite know each other yet at this point, but I can imagine what you were saying at the time.
I wasn't as critical of it as I would be now because I hadn't necessarily seen the writing on the wall for where the center position was going, but it was a situation where there was just not enough real leverage on the table at that point. I think there were very few teams that really had much in terms of cap space, so it was just an unnecessary thing, and this is one of those contracts that is weighing on the team. It hasn't, it's hard to prove what it has really done in terms of a cost, and it's one of the few contracts that would be a serious consideration for another amnesty if that comes a part of the new CBA.
The years on this one were rough. I think they probably overpaid by $1 million or $2 million. I mean, he had been an effective player, and
injuries.
That first year, though, he was better kind of than he looked. You know, he's a little more nimble in the pick and roll than perhaps his body type would have given you credit for. But the 5 years, taking him all the way through age 32, really seemed excessive at that point because he was a restricted free agent. Yeah, he could have taken the qualifying offer, but there really was not necessarily anybody out there. But I guess they felt like they needed to kind of lock everyone up. And that Wolves team wasn't a bad team. They were probably the unluckiest team that I can think of since I've really started following point differentials. I mean, they had the 48-win point differential, and they were like 40 and 42 or something like that. One of the worst clutch teams, too, at that point. So it was too bad for them that in some ways that those contracts didn't work out. But at the same time, we knew that they were going to be ugly. I was more critical of the Kmart contract at age, I think, 29 than I was the Pekovic contract because he at least was 27.
And Kevin Martin could never defend anybody ever. So you know that him aging was always going to make that a bigger problem and that his scoring was going to eventually go off a cliff. A couple other ones.
And I hated that one too because Pekovic and Love obviously is not some great defensive combination at the big positions. And now you're going to add in Kevin Martin as another starter. Like, they needed somebody who could defend.
Yeah. And two other ones I want to mention that are kind of different in their own ways. Jose Calderon to Dallas, 4 years, $29 million. That's one that became an albatross almost instantly just because he's a talented player, but it didn't age particularly well. And then a guy who, I'll be a little bit rude about it, I never liked, JJ Hickson, 3 years, $15 million. Been involved in a few different weird, bad trades, and I just thought he was a guy who didn't really have a place in the league, and giving him 3 years was not a huge mistake, but a mistake.
Yeah, Dallas signed him for his age 32 season that year. And he had a decent year for them. They did make the playoffs, and then they were able to dump him and get Tyson Chandler somehow from the Knicks. That was not a good trade.
Oh, but they had to give up Shane Larkin in the deal. That really hurt them.
Yeah, but Calderon essentially has been dead salary for 3 years now, and I think we kind of knew that was going to be the case as a guy who was very limited other than his shooting offensively, and his defense was, you know, atrocious even when he was starting in Toronto, and at this age now he's basically completely unplayable, but he will be in the mix for some backup point guard minutes in LA this year.
One that I think is the clearest example that I was really wrong on, and there is an incredible parallel to the one I said for the last year, Larry Sanders, 4 years, $44 million, and it was derailed for reasons that I think you could say were outside of basketball, but it could have ended up so much worse for Milwaukee than it did because he left so much money on the table when he was bought out.
Yeah, and I'm guessing they didn't exactly have no idea that he enjoyed smoking marijuana at that point. But I mean, he had played exceedingly well his third year in the league. I thought it was a totally fair deal at the time too, just based on what his performance had been. They had a pretty good defense. He was one of the league's best shot blockers. And then, you know, it all really fell apart for him the following year. Another one that I was wrong on, Monte Ellis in Dallas. I thought that was pretty ugly for $8 million a year. Basically, it was like 3 years, $25 million with that player option in the third year. But that was one of the ones where he was just such a good fit there that, and, you know, remember that $8 million a year at that time was starter money. You know, $10 million a year was starter money. So he was just such a good fit there because he could still get to the basket off of those Dirk pick and rolls that I think he ended up being very effective. And he was part of what was an offense that played at a historic level, at least for half a year in that 14-15 season before they messed it up by getting Rondo.
And one other thing, just because I feel discussing this offseason season would be incomplete without it is the saga that was Andrei Kirilenko.
Yeah, he's opted out of $10 million in Minnesota to sign for 2 years guaranteed at the mini-mid level. It prompted a league inquiry into whether there were any under-the-table shenanigans with Prokhorov and Kirilenko. They're both Russian, and you remember that they put together that alleged super team, which didn't turn out to be so super that year, and Kirilenko was supposed to be part of that, and he succumbed to injuries and essentially never really was an effective NBA player. Again, ended up getting traded to Philadelphia, having a little flap where he like wasn't reporting there and just never really contributed in Brooklyn. And along those lines, too, we would be remiss in discussing that offseason without mentioning the Keith Bogans rule. He is actually is renowned for two concepts on our show. One is the starter who never comes back in the game once he gets taken out. And then also the fact that any contract signed pursuant to a sign and trade must be at least 3 years with 1 year guaranteed. He had to sign a 3-year, $15 million deal just to make the salaries match for that awful trade that they did with Boston. And so, of course, they immediately cut him
Didn't he play on them? He played that season, though, for them.
Yeah, he played that season. But then,
they could have cut him earlier and done a magnificent stretch. But
oh yeah, no, I guess that's true. Yeah, they could have. That's right. They could have stretched him for over 7 years. That would have been great, actually. But no, I guess they cut him as soon as he became non-guaranteed.
I think that would have been better to do it that way.
We have a slight bit of news to talk about. Yi Yanlian signed for 1 year with the Lakers. The reporting on this has differed from the best I can tell from some tweets that may have been the source may have just not given him the exact right information. Mike Bresnahan saying that he could make, it's guaranteed for $1 million, but he could make up to $8 million in incentives. That probably doesn't mean incentives because incentives can only be 15% of the contract. It probably just means that there is a partial guarantee based either on the date or some benchmarks that he has to hit rather than, you know, a specific incentive. But yeah, he could make up to $8 million, I guess, if he makes a team. They want to play him at backup center. They already have Zubac, who is a guy I think they want to develop. They signed Tarik Black for $6 million this year. I think both those guys will probably end up being a little better than E, especially because while he's listed at 28, he is actually 31 and born in 1984. Due to a lot of internet research, pretty much everyone acknowledges that at this point. So he's not a guy to develop. Seems like more of a curio. Basically, I could see signing him on a team that was a little bit closer to contention, didn't have young guys to develop, but this doesn't really make much sense other than the fact that there is an Asian population in LA that might enjoy this.
He'll sell some jerseys, and it also compounds the idea, and I'm not saying he was the best fit for this, of just how unnecessary it was to give Mozgov the years and dollars that they did, because you can always find flyer big men for that. I mean, they think Mozgov is their long-term starter, but just the idea of, and they're overstuffed now at the big man spots, and I think you and I both agree that Luol Deng and Brandon Ingram are both better served at power forward, and there's basically no chance those guys are going to get serious minutes there now.
Yeah, that's a good point on this as well, when we talked about the development that I didn't consider. And I actually think he could play okay. He's looked pretty good. You know, I actually watched a fair amount of film of him when I was watching Emmanuel Mudiay a couple of years ago because they were on the same team in China. And I think, you know, he can jump still pretty well, get up for some alley-oops. He shoots at least, I don't know if he can shoot the NBA three, but he can shoot the FIBA three okay, get some pick and pops. Probably not really going to protect the rim that well or move his feet that well, but I think he could be an adequate backup big in the NBA. He's kind of bulked up the way the game has gone. He can just be a full-time center now. I think he was misplaced, especially defensively as a power forward. So I think he could be okay, but he just doesn't make any sense on this team.
Plus, if the other team decides to play a chair, he can beast on that.
Well, he just avoids the chair, though. That's that was one of just the great little Bill Simmons ditties of him posting up a chair. I do miss those Chad Ford, Bill Simmons mock drafts where they'd make fun of each other's picks constantly. But all right, that'll do it for today, I think. You got anything to plug before we depart?
Yeah, I have two things that aren't out yet. I'm doing Real Jam Radio this week with Derek Bodner. We're going to talk Sixers. He wrote a nice piece on Joel Embiid, and we're going to talk about that and a bunch of other stuff. That will come out on Thursday at some point. And then I'm working on on a kind of a schedule analysis of the Warriors for The Athletic that should hopefully come out on Thursday or Friday.
I don't write anything, so I have nothing to plug, really, other than our friends at Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace. Get those three free meals if you want to test out the service. And then also Framebridge. Use that Capspace code to get 15% off of your first order there as well. Thanks so much for listening. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. We'll be live tweeting all these Olympics games. Looking forward to those. Danny is Danny LaRue. We appreciate everyone who's giving us reviews on iTunes. That always helps us out as well. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you all next time.